So I bring you special greetings from Liberia. Dom, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure since we got connected. It's a God thing to call Dom my brother. You can see the similarity, right? Huh? Very close, right? It takes God to do that. He made them all. Chinese, Europeans, Africans, Americans. He made them all. And he said in his word, that if my name be lifted up, I draw them all. Not some, not few, but all myself. And I'm standing here today because of that love that God has for his children. And he written it. And because of his story, not mine. The story I'm about to share with you is not my story, it is God's story. We all have it. Each of us different. But not better. It's just different stories. We are the characters in his book. He writes the script. He directs everything. And we just act it on the stage. We can't change it. We can't alter it. We just got to fall in line if we want to arrive well. If we want to finish well, we got to fall in line with the story. So what I'm about to share with you today is not a story that I chose. It's a story that he chose and wrote, used my life as a pen to write it out, and then hand over the script to me. I said, now, you'll be a good steward of this story. So I don't have ownership of it. I don't own it. Therefore, I'm not ashamed to share it, and I'm not intimidated by it, and I can't reject it because it's a gift. Have to embrace it. That's just to lay down the foundation for this morning story. You have yours. America has a story. Africa has a story. Everybody has a story. They're not the same. And like I said, it's okay. Because the glory goes back to him, not to us. In the name of Jesus. I bring you special greetings from Liberia, Africa. I arrived about, this is probably my second week in the U.S. since I left about 8 months ago, and I had my first hot water shower when I came back after 8 months of being away. In Liberia, we don't have to take hot water shower because it's always hot. It's always hot. So coffee, there's no such thing as you want a coffee. No, we don't talk much about coffee. We don't talk about hot water. And here, not just in America, you get into the bathroom and you have a choice to either take a hot water shower or a cold water shower or lukewarm shower. So when I got off the plane, it was cold. I first arrived in Detroit, and my friend took me home, and he said, "Well, be at home." And I walk into the bathroom, kind of totally confused. I've lost contact. You know, it's like coming back again to America as a refugee. You know, so I entered the room. I had to remind myself, "Oh, Eric, you are no more in Liberia. You got to switch your caps now. You know, remove the Liberian hat and put on the American hat." So this morning, I bring you a special greeting. If I forgive you, a scripture to talk about this morning, it would be out of the book of Luke, chapter 2, verse 13, all the way to 34. That story, just like my story this morning, is about a rich man in the Bible who worked so hard, very hard. And he made so much wealth, so much things, and said to himself one day, "You know what? I worked so hard, it's time for me to retire and enjoy my life." And he had stuff here and stuff there and have bones here and build a new bones and all of that. And one day, God said, "It's time to come home." And that story goes on and on and on. It talks about the flowers of the earth, how beautiful they are, and after a while, they're gone away. Jesus said, "Work while it is day, for night cometh when no man shall work." And that is true for us. So this morning I want to talk to you about my story, just like that guy. I was born in Liberia, Africa. And last week when Don called me and said, "Hey, we're now in Florida. I want you to come over to see where we are." I came and he told me, "You know, Sister Jan, she was on a trip to Liberia," and Jan, please put your hands together for her, please. I'm not seeing her I've not seen her since 2000 and what's that, 12? When she came to Liberia on the same trip with Don. And he said, you know, we live in the villages around here. And I want you to come over and check out the villages. So I'm thinking African villages. I have no clue the villages he's talking about. So I said, great, I'll come over. And I came over. He drove me back this way the first night. And I'm standing over there just speechless. I can't relate. A lot of similarities, though. So this morning when she said, Jenna, walk here. I didn't know this was a village left to come to my village that morning. And she left from this village to my village in Liberia. I remember she carried water on her head that morning. We went down a hill. This is about 700 feet. It's a very tough hill. You got to go down that hill, carry water in a bucket, bring it on top of the hill. And I didn't know. I thought, you know, the villages are all the same. But having been here now, I know that they're not the same. But it's okay. It's just different. It's okay. So, Jenna, we said thank you so much for coming. And, you know, your husband, I really appreciate seeing you again after almost 5 years. The schools are still there. The water well that you guys built is still there. And people are still drinking out of that water well. And to all my friends here, Gary, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for bringing your wives and everybody along. So you guys are doing a fabulous job. I enjoyed that breakfast that morning. It was great. I look forward to coming back to getting more, you know. Appreciate it. I want to say thank you to my host here, host family that I stay with over there in Center Hill. Appreciate it so much. It's been a great time being at your home. And I have my friends from Illinois. You know, I remember last time we met was in Illinois at the old church. And last night they drove me around. We had a great time. Went out to the barbecue area. You know, and then I had to answer a lot of questions before we ate. But thank you so much for everything. And the rest of you, thank you so much for the opportunity just to be here this morning. Don, I can't stop telling you thank you since we met. So far, Don is the only person that I have remained in consistent contact with since that trip in 2005. And he's been there. I've been to Cottage a couple of times when he was there and met people, and people from that church continued to support the work in Liberia. And then when he moved here, obviously he asked me to come over to visit. I was born in Liberia. Never chose it. God did not talk to me about where I was going to be born. He did not have a meeting with me. We didn't have a discussion about that. He didn't say, Eric, I'm about to create you, but I want you to have an opportunity to choose where to be born. Here in America, you are Americans. You never chose it. You are born here. And there's nothing you can do about it. He didn't talk to me about the color of my skin. He didn't talk to me about the circumstances surrounding my birth. He didn't talk to me about my mom, my dad, whether I like them or don't like them. You know, he didn't talk to me about the environment, the culture. He just made it happen without talking to me about it. That's not fair. So, I never chose it. I don't even know my birthday because my mom never went to school. My parents never went to school, so there was no documentation of birth whatsoever. There was no schools, no hospitals. Our parents give birth through midwifery practices in the village. That's how we do it. I was born in a village where there's no running water, no electricity, where there's no school, no hospitals, no roof. We use thatched roof on our buildings. We slept on dirt floors, and we used clay from the earth to build our beds that we slept on. Therefore, when you build a bed, you cannot change the position of the bed in the house. It's forever. You can't say, I don't like it here, I want to move it this way. No, you can't do that. It's stationary right there in the place. I grew up in a village, a little bit different from the villages around here. In my village, there's no running water. So we had to carry buckets. Sometimes we walk an hour to the river, carry the water on our heads back to the village. I grew up in the village where we have to go hunting as children. After 5 years old, 7 years old, you are old enough to go hunting and we will go hunting for skunks, for groundhogs, sometimes for deer, and sometimes you run into other animals like lions and elephants and snakes, but you are on your own. That's the kind of village I grew up in. In my village, we went on a farm. There was nothing like, oh, when I grow up one day, I would like to be a doctor, a lawyer. I would like to become a president, a superintendent. There was no place to dream at all. We live day by day, straight by faith. As Jesus said, give us this day our daily bread. That's how we live. I grew up in the village where we ate one meal a day. There was no breakfast, no lunch, no dinner. And that one meal a day sometimes came around 3 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night, sometimes 10 o'clock. Mom literally had to wake you up from sleep to eat. In my village, we had to walk to the farm, and the farm was like 3 hours away, one way. And we have to be up by 5 a.m. in the morning or 6 a.m. in the morning. And then mom would put all the water to drink for the day and the food for that day in the bag and place it on our head to carry it 3 hours away to the farm. And then when we come back in the evening, we come back the same way 3 hours later. So when we get home, we are completely exhausted. We just go to bed. That's the kind of village I grew up in. In my village, there was no Christianity. There was no church. We couldn't go to have a meeting to talk about Jesus at Starbucks. Or we have dinner or lunch as we talk about the God of the universe. There's no way. My parents were voodoo worshippers, African religion, animists. That's what they did. That's what I grew up seeing my parents do. They worship dead animals, dead people. And they make a lot of rituals and oracles in the towns. They consult with spirits of the dead. That's what I grew up in. I never chose that. I didn't even know there's something called Christianity, that we can go to church with the AC on and there's coffee in the lobby and we have snacks that you can have. You know, Jesus is wonderful in America. That is the only place it's good to be a Christian, because there, everything is easy. We can drive to church. You don't have to be worried about somebody coming to kill you while you're in church, or being attacked for your faith. So easy. If you come here, you don't like it, you can go to another one. You don't like it, you go to the other one. You don't like it, you go to so much choices. So my village was totally different from the villages I've seen around here. But it doesn't mean better, and it doesn't mean worse. It's just what? Different. So, that was the best part of my life, with my siblings, living with our parents, because there was no civil war. We're not fighting war. Everybody was at home. We came home, we met everybody. And we had parties at night. We made a big fire, and everybody gathered around the fire, and we shared stories. And grandma would share some stories, grandpa would share some stories, and mom would share some stories, and then we get tired, and we go to bed, and the next morning we continue again. Little did we know that our living condition was horrible. We didn't know any better. It's like living in a bubble. We didn't know what was going on outside of our world. We thought this is the way everybody else lives in the world. This is how people in America live. This is how people in Europe live. This is how everybody else in the world lives. So you know what? Let's just deal with it. Let's just get along with it. That's how we thought. Until 1989. In 1989, I guess I was around the age of 12, and I'll tell you the reason why, I guess so, very soon. The Liberian Civil War started. A war that I did not declare. A war that we knew nothing about. Everything is peaceful until we heard that there was war in the country. Within that first year, the war started, and in no time, they have captured the entire country, and they killed all the adults in the country, and they were all left with children now. And they had to recruit children to fight. So the recruitment of children started. If you watch the movie called Blood Diamond, or Pray the Devil Back to Hell, you have a better understanding of what I'm talking about. So I'm staying at home with my parents. When the war started, there was no water, no electricity, there was no store. We don't have Walmart in Africa. We don't have Amazon in Africa. We don't have thrift stores in Africa. What we got, in fact, we don't even have proper gas station. Don would tell you that. We sell our gasoline in jars in the streets. There's no filling station. So in no time, there was no supply in the whole country. People start to die in their homes. Like here in the villages out here, you have running water in the house. You got restroom in the house. You have kitchen in the house. You got a lot of stuff in the house. Over there, my village is different. We have the restroom outside, and we got the kitchen outside, and we got everything else outside. You want to go in the room to sleep, and then you come out in the morning and do everything else outside. But then in the midst of that, there was a curfew. We couldn't leave our house from dusk to dawn. A lot of people died during that process. And one morning, my mom called me and she said, "Eric, you are the oldest in the family. We need you to go fishing." And that was my career. That's what I did as a kid. We went fishing all the time. And she said, "Will you go get some fish for your siblings to eat? There's no food. We're all going to die if you don't go out there and get some fish." I said, "Okay." So I joined a bunch of teenagers. We went fishing. We walked one day to the river, another day back. We're fishing for 2 days. We caught some fish. On my way back home from my 2 days fishing trip, I was captured by child soldiers. These children had automatic rifles. Some were 14, 10 years old, 12 years old, 13 years old. And when they captured us, they said, "We are fighting a war in this country to liberate people like you. And you have time to go fishing. We've never gone fishing for the past 10 years of our life. We've been fighting. Will you join us?" We're not even asking you to decide. We are asking you to join us to fight. And then I said, "I don't know. Of course I don't know." I said, "I can't fight." They said, "You can fight. You can go fishing, therefore you can fight. You have energy to go fishing. We got more serious business to take care of than to go fishing." And then when I refused to join, I was tortured, beaten, and left to die. I got thrown to the ground with my face facing the ground, and one of them stepped right in the middle of my back, pulled my arms to the back, and tied it up until my elbows from the front got to meet in the back. Now, the scars are here on my arms, you can see later on, and they were so tight. The ropes were so tight. And they said, "You have 2 days to decide, or we will help you decide. That means we're going to kill you." And I was thrown into a jail house, somebody's house that was turned into a jail house. At this point in time, in my country, in my village, there was no government. There was no police, no army. There was no judges, no lawyers. The guy with the gun is the man in charge. So my mercy lies in the hands of those children. So I was in jail. 2 days later, they brought me out of the jail and they said, "Today is the day of decision making. You decide today what's going to happen." So they removed the ropes from my arms, and when the ropes were removed, my arms have become paralyzed because the ropes are so tight that my blood stopped flowing for those 2 nights. So I couldn't feel anything in my arms. So one of them took a needle and he stuck it into my arms, and I couldn't feel anything. And he said to the rest of the guys, "We can't use him. He's worthless to himself and worthless to us. So there's no point in killing him. Let him go." That was God at work. I didn't write this story. I didn't choose this. Therefore, I couldn't do anything about it. So I got set free, but they told me, "You can't go home anymore. You got to go this way. You can't go that way because that way has been captured by enemy forces, and we don't want you going there. So you go this way." That was the beginning of a 20-year journey away from home. Never saw my mom again. Never saw my dad again. I went back to that community, to that village that I grew up in, and I headed west. Joined a bunch of refugees, and we were on the run. We didn't know where we were going. We had no passport, no ID card, no identification, no address. You're just going. Until we arrived at the refugee camp where I met a lady from Switzerland. She works for the International Committee of the Red Cross. And in this refugee camp of about 50,000 people, we had to stand in line with a plate and a spoon to get to the only kitchen where they feed everybody. There's a big kitchen in the refugee camp. So I stood in the line. I cannot hold a plate, but I'm hungry. I want to get food, but I can't hold a plate. So I just stood up in the line. And normally the line would start around 6 o'clock in the morning till maybe 8 or 10 p.m. or not. You just keep standing. So I got to the kitchen and she said, "What's your plate?" I said, "I don't have a plate." She said, "What happened to you?" I said, "Well, long story." She said, "Well, please get out of the line. We will talk about that later when we are done with the work today." And I stood up there all day until she was done. And then I explained to her what happened. And she said, "It's unfortunate. We are humanitarian workers. We are not supposed to be involved with something like this. But we have a plan. We can help some of you guys leave the country to get medical help because there's no hospitals, no doctors, no nurses in the country right now. Everybody have gone." So they placed us in a big old truck. At the beginning of the truck and at the front of the truck, they stack up some rice and beans and oil to disguise us in the back because she was going to get killed if the government ever find out that she was helping people to leave the country. And that's what happened until we crossed the border from Liberia into Ivory Coast, a French-speaking country, around the age of 12. How do I know that? They told me to go and register with the government. I'm a refugee from Liberia, so I go to register. And the guy asked me, "How old are you? What's your age?" That was the first question, first time ever I've ever heard somebody ask somebody about their age. And I'm standing there. I don't know what to say. I look at the guy. I say, "I don't know." And he's like, "Well, he can't be more than 12 years old." So I pick on that. And then read the Chinese Zodiac book. And I realized, okay, I think there's similarities for the month of August, so took August. So I give myself a birthday. But you know what? It doesn't matter what day I was born. What matters is the reason why. So he wrote on the paper. And then he said to me, "You are not a refugee. You don't meet the definition of a refugee because you are a minor. And we don't know if your parents are dead, so you cannot be considered an orphan either. So we have a situation here, a big problem. So you know what? Just hang around in the refugee camps and later on we see what to do." So they took my picture, wrote a little story about me, and they had a big war in the Red Cross office, in the government office, all the children with no parents, and they call unaccompanied minors. That's the description. So they just put everything there and said, "Well, hopefully we can get somebody to give us some information about your parents." And I hung out in the camp for weeks, for months. There was no parent. And one day a lady showed up and they said, "This lady wants to take you home." So she took me home and they give my food to her and my ration to her. And we stand in the tent and refugee life, you have no idea what I'm talking about. We live in tents on the dirt floor. When the rain falls, the place is muddy. You cannot sleep at night. There's no food. We got to stand in line and wait for food from Japan, from the United States, from Europe to come in before we could ever eat. Most times, young people have no food because they said the food they had is for the older folks or for the very young. So those of us in the train, we were left out. That led to a lot of stealing, prostitution on the parts of the women in the camp, and the guys like us, we stole people's sheep, chicken, and goats to survive in that village. So finally, this lady told me, "We cannot allow your arms to remain this way. We got to do something about it." So she took the kitchen knife and she said, "Follow me." I followed her. We went into the jungle and she cut the bamboo. You know what a bamboo tree is? She cut the bamboo tree. She measured my arms from here to here. And then she split it into two, smoothed it, and used it as a splint. Put a piece this way and put another piece this way. And she tied it with a rope from the bush. And every evening she would remove the ropes around 5 p.m., boil the water outside, and use the earth from the ground and massage my arms. And use the earth as a powder and put the splint back on. I never saw a therapist. I went to a doctor. I went to any hospital. And after a few months, I got splint back into my arms. And then I had to leave. For the next 14 years, I walked by foot with thousands of other refugees. We went to 10 different nations by foot, no ID cards. And sometimes we were caught and thrown into jail. We couldn't speak the language, so we stayed there until God could release you. We got to borders where we had nobody at the borders, and we have no documents for immigration. So we stood up there as children and watched the parents cross the border with their kids. And sometimes we disguised ourselves as a member of that family, and we would follow the family unknown to them. And the government would think, they're our family. We're not our family. They don't know me. And that's how we crossed some of the borders in Africa. Until I arrived in Nigeria. When I arrived in Nigeria, life there was horrible again. Very horrible. So, why all these stories? Why all these, you know, heartbreaking stories? What happened? Well, what happened is a country called Liberia. Liberia was founded by freed American slaves that went back to Africa in the 1820s. Liberia, as the name suggests, comes from the word liberty, which means the land of the free. Most of the slaves came from the south, the northern part of America. When you go to Liberia, we have Virginia in Liberia. We got Maryland in Liberia. We got Mississippi in Liberia. We got most of the cities in America there in Liberia, but not the same. It's different. When the slaves arrived in Liberia, they soon became slave owners themselves. Human nature, right? Soon became slave owners. And that situation was never taken care of until 1980, when I was around the age of 12, and the Civil War broke out. In Liberia today, we are the only nation that have no running water nationwide, no electricity nationwide. We use generator all over the place. We are the only nation with 60% of our children never been in any room of education at all. There, the minimum wage a month is $100. That's the minimum wage. A month. Not per day, a month, $100. That is the salary of a teacher, the salary of a nurse. It's $100. Police officer make $100 a month. It's a place where we have 80%, 85% unemployment. In fact, right now it's 95% unemployment rate. 95% unemployment rate. So it's a big problem with no infrastructure. And here we are as children that have gone away from our homes for all these years. And we are being told by the rest of the world that this is the future of Liberia. This is the future of Africa. What is the future? Children who are not educated, children who don't have any opportunity, have no hope. How are they going to be possibly the future of their country? So I decided that education, a Christ-centered education, is the way to go. And how do I know that to be true? When I was in the refugee camp in Nigeria, a friend of mine gave me one computer as a gift, and I brought a computer in the refugee camp with a small generator to power just that one computer. So I became overnight like Donald Trump or Bill Gates in the refugee camp. I had so much money in the camp compared to everybody else in the camp. I was a big dog in that camp. And I got up one morning. At this point, I'm conscious of my Christian faith. And how did I become conscious? When I was in Guinea, another French-speaking country, we were over 150,000 refugees from Somalia, Ethiopia, Sudan, South Sudan, Liberia, Sierra Leone, refugees from all over Africa. And we didn't want to have anything to do with God. We didn't want to hear about the gospel. We didn't want to hear about Jesus because we felt like God is not real. If God so much loved the world that he gave his only begotten son for his children, why would we be stuck where we are stuck? Country is gone, family gone, nation gone, everybody gone. You are a refugee in a foreign country. You have no address. You can't speak the language. You have no food to eat, no water to drink, no education. You just have nothing. How do you explain God's love to a person in such a situation? So we didn't want to have anything to do with God. But, however, there were still pastors that we called radical for Jesus that were still coming. They kept coming, even though we were not talking to them. They kept coming. And one of them
came around Christmas, just around this time. It was around the 23rd of Christmas, 1992. And normally these pastors had a very good strategy, very effective strategy. Their strategy was, we would go into the refugee camp 4 a.m. in the morning and preach from 4 to 6 or 7 a.m. while the refugees are still in their tents. We're not running around looking for food. It works. So that morning, one of the pastors came and he used a bullhorn preaching in the refugee camp. And he got stuck around the area where I was living. And he said, I want to ask you a question. We're about to get into a new year. I want to know when you stand with God. Are you still running away from Him? And he said, what did you do to save your own life out of the carnage in your country, the civil war? A war that killed so many people that you know, took away your parents, took away your community, took away everything. What did you do to save your own life? How fast could you run? How strong were you? How swift were you? How intelligent were you? What did you do if you can tell me what you did? And I couldn't answer the question. And he said, how is the religion your parents taught you working out for you? The voodoo? Islam? Whatever it is? How is it working out for you? Where is the U.S. government? Everything you trusted, the government, where is that government today? Where's the Liberian government? Where is the United Nations? And he said, you know what? There's just one man. His name is Jesus. Let's save you. And he saved you for a reason. That's why you are still alive. That's why everything else that happened that should have killed you did not kill you. And that Jesus is still waiting for you patiently. One day, some of you from this refugee camp will return home as the Nehemiahs of your generation to rebuild the fallen walls of the country. And he said, if you believe in what I have just said and you want to give Jesus a chance, you tried everything else and it has not worked, then I want you to close your eyes wherever you are and I will pray for you. For the first time in my life, I closed my eyes in that refugee camp on the dirt floor. Never came outside to see this pastor. He prayed the sinner's prayer. And after that, he said, I don't have a Bible to give you. I don't have a church to recommend to you. I don't have food or water, no water to give you to drink. But Jesus has a way of taking care of his people. And he said, find other Christians in a refugee camp and learn about your new faith. And I found a Christian brother who used to live with some Baptist missionaries in Liberia. And he started to teach me how to read the Hina, and that was the beginning of my Christian walk. Fast forward in Nigeria, when I got that computer in 2002, I was reminded about to whom much is given, much is required. Even though I was a refugee in the camp, I didn't have $1 million in my account. I didn't have much of a formal education. I didn't have any planning, any structure. But God gave me something, even in the midst of misery. That was a computer and a generator. And that we've been blessed to be a blessing. That when you drink, you must go out to the restroom. It must reciprocate. It must be reciprocated. So I became conscious of that, and I decided that, okay, what do I do with this, Lord? It is not how much you have given me. It is what I do with the little that you have given me that makes all the difference. So what do I do with this computer? And he placed in my heart to start teaching other young people in the refugee camp how to use the computer. So the school got started. That was the beginning of Change Agent Network. And I started to train people. The first week alone, we had 100 students from all over Africa. And they come to my room. I tell them, put a computer on the table, and I say, hey, here is the system unit. This is the monitor. This is the keyboard. Here is the speaker. You got it? Yeah, this is the mouse, right? Yeah, bring your hand. And I position their hand on the mouse, and I show them how to move the cursor around on the screen. And that was amazing for them because that was the first time they ever seen a computer. And that was the end of the class for the day for that student. And that's how we started with one computer. And as people came to the camp from the Salvation Army, from Save the Children, from World Vision, they came over and they said, what are you doing here? And I said, hey, this is the school. Are you crazy? How do you open the school in a refugee camp with no paycheck? How are you going to pay the worker? How are you going to provide for fuel? How are you going to provide for that? I said, I don't know. And really, I don't need to know. God will take care of his own. By 2005, we have gotten about 17 computers donated by different groups. We trained about 700 refugees using that one computer. Out of that one computer today, the press secretary to the president of Liberia, he learned how to use that computer from that camp in Liberia. So, that computer gave me something to hold on to. It changed the course of my life. It added more value to myself in the camp. God used that one computer to give me a sense of direction, give me something to give back, something to look forward to, a message to take back to Liberia, that education is the way to go. So fast forward the story. In 2006, we are in the refugee camp, and we heard a lot about America, a lot. All we knew was that America was God's kingdom on earth. That if you come to America with any problem, and the problem is not solved here, you just forget it until Jesus comes back. There's no hope for you. And the reason for that we taught this was the headquarters for God. That God, Jesus, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they all live here, and they have their offices here in America. That's what we taught. And the reason for that is because you listen to all the Christian songs, all from America. You meet missionaries, they're from America. All the powerful preachers that we know, pastors around the world, they're all from America. So this has got to be God's headquarters. So we're in the camp one day, and the war in Liberia has spread out to Sierra Leone, to Ivory Coast. It has engulfed into a regional war. It has developed into a regional war. We had about 5 different nations now at war, right from the situation in Liberia. So we have Ivory Coast, a French-speaking country, Guinea, another French-speaking country, Sierra Leone, a former British colony, with Liberia and American combined. It's a big mess. And then 9/11 took place here in America. At that time, it was a breeding ground for terrorism by Osama bin Laden in that area. So President George W. Bush, with the help of the French and the British, sent a 15,000-strong UN peacekeepers to Liberia. And the entire war came to an end automatically. But we've been gone for over a decade and a half. A million plus left their homes, like me. How do we come back home? What kind of home are we returning to? So the U.S. government came to the refugee camp in those Chevy-tinted dark cars that you don't know who's driving the car, but you just see the car moving around. And they come in there like, hey, we are here from the State Department. We have come to assess the humanitarian needs and to say we are just kind people. We want to help you guys out. And where we are, we were like, where you been for 15 years? They're like, well, we have come. We know some of you have been here for so long. So we'd love to help you with repatriation, to repatriate you back to your country. We're going to provide aircrafts and ships to take you back to your home country. And some of you who cannot go back home, we're going to try to help you to settle down here in Nigeria. And for some of you that have a compelling story, we're going to help you resettle in the developed nations of the world. But you got to write your story. Again, your story. We want to hear what happened to you. We want to know what you've been through. So they give us the immigration form to fill out. And then we fill out the form. They had 3 criteria they were going to use to determine who comes to America, who goes to Canada, Australia, and other developed nations of the world. Number 1 criteria was what they call long-stay refugees, which means you must have been in a refugee camp consistently for more than 10 years. You never left. You've been stuck there for 10 years. At this point, I was going to my 14 years in the camp, overqualified for that. 2nd was, you've been tortured and abused, and you have scars. You can prove what happened to you. Give us names, give us descriptions. And I have scars all over my body. And then I explained. And then they said, well, Eric, you met the criteria, welcome to America, we'll be taking you to the States. And on my form, the immigration form, they wrote LA, final destination in America. I was thinking Los Angeles. I never thought of Louisiana, right? So it was a Louisiana, a great place. So we got on the plane. My first culture shock was leaving the camp. And they brought us to the airport in Nigeria and said, you are leaving today for America. I have mixed feelings. Don't know what to think, what to say. And before we got on the plane, they gave us a little form to fill out and said, hey, this is a promissory note. You need to sign promising that you're going to pay back the travel loan. This is a loan that has been given to you by the Catholic Church, and you got to repay this loan, $3,000, so that we can help other refugees come over to America. And then I look at the amount, it was $3,000. I quickly did the math in African money, it was like $3 million. So I look at the lady, I say, you know what, this is a trick. We're not going. And I told my guys, hey, we're not going to go. This is a trick. And she's like, why not? I said, look, we have not even gone yet. Now we owe you $3 million. When we get there, only God knows how much we're going to owe you. So why is this important? You want to help? Why didn't you just help? And she said, no, you know, this is going to be your first line of credit. It's a first line of credit? What is the second line of credit that you're not telling us? This is the first line, and it's this much. So I said, you know, we're not going. And the whole place was trouble. And then she came back to me and said, Eric, you need to stop staring trouble. You guys get on the plane. And I said, no, we're not going to go. This is too much money. We don't borrow money in Liberia. Nobody loan you money here. And I'm owing this much money. We're not going to go. And she said, you know what? Just go. You will be able to pay this money. You have 5 years to pay. $3,000. And she said, I said, what if I don't pay? She said, well, no problem. I said, okay, great. I'm not going to sign. So we got on the plane. Sitting on the plane. And as we got on the plane, there's these people eating. Some people on their laptops. You know, watching movie, having wine. It's a strange world. Completely strange. Either I was the alien or those people were the aliens. But we had somebody on the plane that's an alien. I didn't know what to think, where we were headed. And the flight attendant came over and said, do you want something to eat? And I said, no. Because I'm thinking, I did not sign that paper, so there's no point in eating. So we arrived in Frankfurt, Germany the next day. It was cold. It was in August 2006, around the 27th of August. And I got off the plane. Don't know where to go. It's a massive airport. Everybody's just running like crazy. I know where they're going. So they have given us a bag. We have no passport. No, nothing. Can I use a bag, please? So they give us a bag, and on the bag they wrote IOM, meaning International Organization for Migration. And they said to me, you can't open this bag, and you can't hide it, and you cannot squeeze it. You got to hold the bag for everybody to see what you carry. So at the airport in Frankfurt, I'm standing there, and this strange woman walked up to me, and she said, Eric, welcome to Germany. I said, thank you. And I said, but I don't even know you. I've never met you. How do you know my name? And she said, oh, the bag that you have identifies who you are. You are one of my clients. Please follow me. I'm going to help you to connect you with your final flight to America. This is not America. And I followed that woman blindly in the camp. That was God at work. We arrived in Chicago the next day around 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and I'm sending that again, and the U.S. immigration comes up and says, hey, can I have the bag? I'm like, what? I took this bag around the world for 24 hours. How sure am I that you're the guy I'm supposed to give it to? It's a U.S. immigration, and I give it to him. And he said, follow me. We follow, and he said, sit down. It's going to take a couple of hours. Be patient. And then he goes into that room. Today, I don't know what was in that bag. I don't know. I have no clue what was in it. I took it around the whole world. I still don't know what was in the bag. And he comes out. He said, we got to do your fingerprints. Did all my fingerprints. And he said, welcome to America. You are not here on a student visa. You are not here on a work visa. You are not here because of anything. You are here because the American people wanted to give you this opportunity for you to come here. You've been through a lot. But you don't have to go back there again. Your final destination is L.A. So they put me on the plane, and I got to Houston Airport on my way to Lafayette, Louisiana. Got there, don't have a bag anymore. I just have the boarding ticket. So I'm going in circles. You know how you guys communicate with computers everywhere? So in the airport, there's computers everywhere. Nobody's talking to anybody. So I don't know what gate, what boarding gate, what flight, whatever. I don't know. And I went in circles in the airport forever until 8 p.m. And I just said to myself, you know, Eric, this is dumb. Just talk to somebody. So I called a guy, a Sushan guy. I said, hey, excuse me, my name is Eric. How do I get here? He looks at me and he said, what's your password? I said, I don't have a password. He said, how did you get in the airport? I said, I don't know. His eyes just went. His eyes just went like that. He said, you don't know how you got here? I don't know. And that's the truth. I don't know how they got into the airport. So he called the cops and they came over and they took my tickets and they started to make some communication and back and forth. Oh, refugees from Liberia, he's headed to Lafayette. That's when I knew I was going to Lafayette. So they put me on the plane. I arrived in Lafayette August 28, 2006. I got off the plane. It's a small airport. There's a strange lady standing there and I walk out of the place and she said, oh, Eric, my name is Miss Margaret. I'm going to be your caseworker for 6 months. I said, caseworker? In Liberia, that's a negative term. It means you committed a crime. It's like a lawyer or a counselor, a legal counselor. I said, look, I didn't sign that paper. She said, no, my job is to help you get acclimated to your new environment, understand your new country, and all of that. So I'm going to be assigned with you, so get used to being around me. So we got in the car. As we drove from the airport, the car is cold. And then I looked through the windows. I couldn't find a single soul in the street. Everybody driving cars. The world has changed in less than 24 hours. It's kind of flipped over. And then I asked the lady, I said, where's everybody at? I can't see nobody in the street. Because in Liberia, in my village, we walk everywhere. All day, all night. We walk to church. We walk home. We walk everywhere. That's what we do. That's why we go to church late. Because we had to walk. And I said, where's everybody? She said, look at them. I said, I don't see nobody. I see vehicles moving. And she said, that's right, Eric. Everybody owns a car out here. I said, what? Every single one of you drive a car out here? And she said, yes. And then I said, why did you bring me here? I'm never going to drive. I'm never going to be able to own a car. And she said, Eric, you are just coming. Cool down. You will figure it out. And then I asked her the next question. I said, in Africa, we ask for directions, right? If I'm coming to the whole community church, I would start asking a question there. And they would tell me, go past that big tree, and there's a blue house, go behind that blue house, and there's a lady selling the ice cream. She's been doing that for 20 years. Just go past her up, and you find the church. So how do you get around? And she said, oh, there's something called a GPS. Remember, I'm just arriving. GPS, what is that? She said, it's a piece of little computer device that helps us to get around. So you drive around talking with computers. That's what you do. And she said, yes. So we arrive in my first apartment on the University of Louisiana campus at Lafayette. And we got there. She opened the room. It's a one-bedroom apartment. Walk into the room. There's a king-size mattress there with 10 pillows on the bed. And she said, this is your bed. I'm like, my bed? I've never owned a bed before. My parents never owned a bed. My generation never owned a bed before. In my village, nobody had a bed like that. And she said, this is your bed. And I look at the bed with 10 pillows. I'm like, what am I supposed to do with 10 pillows? I can't even handle one. You got 10 on this bed. The lights were so bright. The carpets were so clean. I don't know what to think. It's been 24 hours and the whole world just kind of went crazy. And she said, I got to show you a couple of things in the house before I leave you alone tonight. Come with me in the kitchen. So we go to the kitchen, and there's this microwave box sitting there. And she said, this is the microwave most Americans use to cook in the heat of their food. And I said, what? This little box? There's no fire in it, no smoke, no nothing. How do you cook in the box with no fire? And she said, oh, it uses electricity. I said, okay, I got that. And then she said, your food. And then she opened this fridge. Double doors, goes like that. And there's milk, there's butter, there's bread, all kinds of stuff is full. And she said, this is your food. We expect you to eat. You are toast skimming. And every Saturday, I'm going to come and replenish. I'm like, what? All this food for one person to eat? And she said, yes. I couldn't believe. God is good. And I just had the idea that, Eric, you need to start shipping food to Liberia. She's going to bring more next Saturday. So that's a good program to start. And then she said, I got to show you the temperature control in the house. You know, Americans normally call people weird. That's weird. So they show me, he said, the temperature control. We come over, said, this is the temperature control here. I'm like, what does that do? She said, oh, we control the temperature in the house. You control temperature out here? I said, yes. Yeah, when it's too cold, you can adjust it. When it's too hot. And I said, you know what? I've had enough. Just go home. I see you tomorrow. Right? Because where I come from, when it is hot. And there's nothing you can do to control a tank. That was the beginning of my culture shock and the formation of change agent network in America. And then I started to realize that America is just different from every other country. So much blessed, so much stuff that you cannot even imagine what could be done in the rest of the world. I realized sooner or later that they feed the birds in America every day. They just feed them. So much food. I also realized that they have so much choices that you go to drink coffee, you got to make decisions about drinking coffee. What kind of sugar you want? What kind of milk? Cashew milk, 2%, 3% milk? Honey milk? Almond milk? Choices. You go to Albertson, Walmart, there's 3 aisles of chips. It's all chips, left and right. And sometimes we got to fight about what we want. And then you start observing what's going on. You go, you want to get a drink, and you want a Coke, they say, what kind of Coke you want? And they give you 15 flavors. Choices, never seen them before. One morning I got in my apartment, I come outside, and there's this squirrels running around the place. And I remember that's what I used to do. I'd track it down, and we'd roast it, or we'd make a good soup. So I tried to catch the squirrel, and the apartment manager come out and said, you can't do that here. I'm like, why not? The squirrel, we just eat it. And she said, no, you can't do that. You go to jail. Me, go to jail for eating squirrels? And she said, I said, who does that? He said, well, they are protected by law. Squirrels are protected by law only in America. And then I said, who does that? He said, Uncle Sam. Who is Uncle Sam that protects squirrels? So we go out one day, I'm coming back, and my head is just spinning. I'm taking everything in and processing what's going on. Who are these people that I have been brought among? We come out. We went out one night coming back home, and he's driving. I'm sitting in the passenger seat, 3 other persons in the back. And then we saw the first deer cross the road, and the second deer, and the third deer. I'm like, hit it. And everybody in the car just go, what's wrong with you? We can't hit it? That's why not? He said, well, they protect it. I soon realized that my host had raccoons in the yard, that he feeds them. I also soon find out that he has some stray cats in the yard that he feeds. And one day, without him knowing, he asked me to go with him to PetSmart. And I'm just taking it all in. We go to PetSmart, and I'm standing there. I look at all these beautiful pets. They do their nails, their hair, they're well done. They're in cages with air conditioning on. There's a frozen section of food for them in the place. And their food is well packaged with nice pictures, and they have magazines stacked shelves to the front. I'm like, these people are so different. So I'm sitting there looking, where is this place on earth? And I go to him, his name is Mr. Jerry Abeck. I said, Jerry, where is this place? He said, oh, Eric, sorry, I didn't tell you. This is a supermarket for pets. What? A supermarket for pets. Say, yeah, just for pets. Hey, yes. So what did we come to do here today? He said, I brought my dog and the cat for an appointment with the doctor. Only in America. You brought your dog for an appointment with the doctor. Yeah. And the doctor is there. He's taking records. He's listening. And then I come out, I'm like, these people are so weird. We have a doctor for pets. So finally, we got in the car. And he said, help me with some bags of corn. We put the corn in the truck. And I said, what are you going to do with the corn? He said, oh, Eric, we're going to go Mississippi next month to go hunting. So how do you go hunting with a bag of corn? He said, well, we feed the deer and then we shoot it. So I'm just taking everything in. Okay, you feed the deer and then you shoot it. So why feed it? Just shoot it. And give me the corn money. Let me go build some more schools, right? Just shoot it. No need to buy corns. So we come home. In the Gulf of Mexico, a lot of people in Louisiana go fishing in the Gulf. So he said, hey, we're going to take you out to go fishing. I said, I'm thinking fishing to come and eat, not to play sports. So we got in the boat, we go out there in the Gulf, and he gave me the hole, and I caught the first fish, and he said, no, Eric, throw it back into the water. Caught the second fish, oh, no, Eric, throw it. I said, okay, hold on. So what did we come to do? Did we come to get fish to eat? It looks like you came to play sport. He said, oh, yeah, just for the fun. Then I knew that, Eric, God has brought you here on the mission. If America can solve all of these problems, take care of the pets have so much hope. There's a protection agency for them. There's an adoption program for them. They have a daycare. They have a cemetery. They have a supermarket. They have hospitals. They have a protection agency to protect the pets. What will you say to the children of Liberia that are made in God's image? What will you say to people who have nothing and you now have become the ambassador of those children here in America? How can you keep silence? You're not asking Americans to sell everything they have and to take care of children, but at least the same heart. And what made my situation worse, it gave me a lot of hope, was that one morning I turned on the television and I'm watching TV and Anderson Cooper on CNN was talking about animal obesity. And he goes, it's going to cost the U.S. government $48 billion to fight animal obesity in America. I'm like, my goodness, they're going to spend that much money. Anderson Cooper, he's talking about it. And God just dropped in my spirit and said, these people have so much hope that even the pets in the homes have hope. But what was shocking to me was the level of depression in the midst of abundance of resources. I go to places, people don't laugh, they don't joke. I was taken to the prisons, Angola prison in Louisiana, to speak to the inmates. We walk into the prison, and the sheriff is like, we wanted to share your story with these prisoners, you know, so they can know that there's real problems in the world. And I walk into the prison. This is supposed to be a prison. And we walk there, they have towels everywhere. They have a gym where they go to the gym. They have a cafeteria, and they get to pick what they want to eat, even in the prison. They have a plate, and they can take, and don't want that, and take this, don't like that, go back this way, and if you like, get something else. In the prison, they have mattresses and bed sheets and pillows for prisoners to sleep on. In the prison, they have cell phones phones to call, and there's television on. And the hospitals, and the dryer, and the laundry machines. And I told them, I'm like, hey, this is a prison? And he's like, yeah, this is the prison. You see all these guys, they're going through hell, a lot of problems. You know, we don't know what they're doing. So I'm like, you know what? I can't help them. But I can suggest something. And he said, what's that? I said, let us have a prisoner exchange program. I want to take all the prisoners with me. And I bring you my own prisoners. And we laugh. But in the midst of all of this, I've told you, I couldn't stay here. The U.S. government gave me a citizenship. I said, I don't want it because I was here, but my mind, my heart was behind there. And I started to think, Ever, what are you going to do with all these tourists? You are one in the million that was brought to America, the number one country in the world, the most richest, most powerful, most influential nation. That makes you number one citizen of the world. And that comes with a huge expectation from God. But what are you going to do? So I decided to return to Liberia with a green card. Ever since then, I went home. I phoned my parents in 2008, my mom. We got reunited, became a Christian as a result of the work I do today. She's the mother of the church. All the family members who were non-Christian are all Christian today. Went back home and decided to talk to the Americans, to beg them all over the country to help us transform Liberia through education. Because the education worked for me without one computer. And I learned. I went to other schools in the camp. I learned by myself and changed my life. Coming to America today, for 200 years, America has provided free education for people from the high school level. 200 years. That makes the American public the most educated public in the world. They make informed decisions. They can run small businesses. They can become doctors and lawyers and entrepreneurs. They can become pastors because the education was given to them. I believe education because it is the only gift that you give to a person that when they die with it. Nobody takes it away from them. Everything else will be taken away, but the gift gets buried at the end of the year. So I decided to go back to Liberia. Not just to give education, but to give Christ-centered education. Give the children a foundation in Christ first, and then teach them how to read and write and earn a good living. In the process, you teach them how to live well as well. So because of that, I went back home, and we started to build these schools. We have built 14 schools in Liberia. Currently, I'm responsible for managing 5 of the 14 schools. That was one of the schools that John came up to. In our schools, they're not like schools here. No comparison. They have no cafeterias. We have no school buses. Our kids walk to school. And when they come to school, they spend 5 hours, they walk back home. Our teacher's salary is around $60, $80, $100 a month. That's a teacher's salary per month. One textbook for the entire classroom. The teacher gets to keep that textbook. And he or she writes on the board for the kids to write. That's the kind of school we are talking about. These schools are self-sustaining locally. Most of our children, we made them to bring chickens for school fees. They bring goats for school fees. They bring beans for school fees. They bring charcoal for school fees. And we take these items and convert them into cash to pay the teachers their salaries. The local people build their own schools. They run it. They sustain it. The American public give a one-time donation to buy building materials and build a school and give it a name, and they can come and visit to invest into that community like Don did and Jen did it one time and come back. We as an organization provide expertise. I had to let go of the American citizenship to do this because I think it's the most important thing to be done. I came back from Africa 2 weeks ago while I was gone for 8 months. On this trip, we are hoping to open a brand new school in the northern part of the country. And my vision is to transform the entire country to Christ-centered education, county by county. And we have built 15 so far since 2008. So it means that we can do more. It's possible. It can be accomplished. And what an opportunity it leads to change an entire country, not just a little project, a little community, but a whole country can be transformed. So on this trip, we have a brand new school. We're going to be building decks, classroom decks for them to open come January the 17th. And we have an 18-wheeler container in Louisiana that we've been gathering what I call yesterday's treasure, tomorrow's hope. These are computers, textbooks, materials that most Americans don't like because they got a new iPhone, the old iPhone get to go, a new laptop, the old laptop we get to take it and put it to work for them. So we've got to ship that container. And also I'm looking forward to moving to Florida because of Don and my connection in the area to sell it here and start another ministry in this part of the country. So I love you guys to keep me in your prayers as we make this thing work. I'm supposed to head back to Liberia at the end of January again to continue with the work over there. I believe God has called me to talk about what's going on over there with you guys, and then go over there to show the kindness and the generosity of how good life is in America. If you were to ever decide where to live in this world, or where to be born, apart from America, or including America, where would that place be? Before we begin to fuss and fight about things sometimes that don't really matter. I talk to people sometimes, the greatest pain is that the iPhone is not working, they can't text. So you have no idea, Eric, how terrible my life is, my iPhone is not working. The microwave would not just work. And things that get people upset sometimes, I look at it, it's different. And I just got to put up and get along. I want to say thank you so much this morning. I encourage you to keep praying for us. If you can't go on a mission, you can give to mission. If you can't give to mission, you can pray for mission. But there's no neutral ground. You either are going, and that means you have to abandon everything to go. And those who are here that are working have to make sure you have what you need as you go. Or they are praying for you as you go. So we all have a part to play. Whether you are in church or out of church, it took that pastor that morning to bring me to the Lord. Somebody paid for him to go to that camp. I never met him, never spoke with him. But here I am today. As I receive that gospel, I'm sharing that gospel to them. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man soweth, so shall he reap.